Good evening, this is Mary Wilson with Checkpoint on National Radio. On the programme this evening, a setback to a Māori land settlement, angry Aucklanders take to the streets over the power crisis, and a Friday the 13th brush with death. First though, Radio New Zealand News with Chris Whitter.
Good evening. The $40 million treaty settlement that has been reached between the Crown and the Opotiki-based Whakatohia tribe is to be terminated. The Crown and the tribal negotiators signed a deed of settlement in October 1996. But there's been disagreement amongst the tribe's negotiators about the package. Claire Paisley reports.
Minister Doug Graham says it's now clear that there is insufficient support for the deed of settlement among Whakatohia's negotiators. A formal ratification proposal was not put to the tribe's beneficiaries, and some of the negotiators want to conduct further research in support of their claim. Mr Graham says no settlement would be durable in those circumstances, and it's best for the parties to return to square one. This is the first time a deed of settlement has had to be abandoned. From Parliament, Claire Paisley.
About 200 protesters marched through central Auckland's Queen Street today to show their anger over the power crisis, but the tone of the march upset a potential ally. The group of students, retailers, residents and workers braved the heavy rain to join the Queen Street Black Friday march, organised by the group Empower Auckland. Sharon Brett-Kelly reports.
What do we need? Need it! What do we need? When do we need it?
The crowd was much smaller than the thousands expected by Empower Auckland, which represents businesses, retailers and residents. But the hundreds of people on Queen Street during the lunch hour heard the noisy, angry message from the protesters that they want immediate compensation and accountability from Mercury Energy. The target of the chants and placards was Mercury Energy's chief executive, Wayne Gilbert, with protesters demanding he and the board quit. Meanwhile, a director of the Mercury Energy Board, John Collins, left the protest early because he was upset by the placards and chants abusing Wayne Gilbert. In Auckland, Sharon Brett-Kelly.
Social Welfare Minister Roger Sari says all responses which come in from the public on the proposed Code of Family and Social Responsibility will be analysed. He says he may have to ask the Cabinet for more money if the response rate is higher than the 10% that's been budgeted for. Mr Sari was responding to comments from the Social Policy Agency General Manager John Angus about how the public consultation would be handled. Mr Angus said the overwhelming response rate meant that those which came from groups would be analysed, but it wouldn't be possible to read all the individual responses. Three people escaped serious injury when a steel girder from a nearby construction site pierced through the roof of their flat today. A 12-metre steel beam weighing about 5 tonnes dropped from a crane working on extensions to an inner-city hotel. Mary Jane Agate reports.
Police say residents of an Elliott Street flat are lucky to be alive after the beam fell through the roof of their flat this morning. One of the residents, who was asleep at the time, says it was really scary and he didn't have a clue what was going on.
I figured that someone had got killed, eh? It was just like nasty, nasty sounds, and it was a big relief after I found that they were okay, eh?
And Andrew Oliver, who was cutting hair at a nearby salon, says he thought a bomb had gone off. Police evacuated the building and an OSH inspector is currently investigating the site. In Auckland, Mary Jane Agate.
The Court of Appeal has agreed with the Crown a self-confessed teenage sex abuser must go to jail. At the request of the Crown, it's quashed the youth's 2-year suspended sentence and replaced it with a 3.5-year full-time jail sentence. The youth was a 15-year-old resident of an Auckland foster home in 1996 when he sexually abused 2 fellow foster children aged 6 and 8 and his foster parents' 3-year-old daughter. The youth's lawyer said it was a special case as the boy had himself been badly sexually abused and is highly traumatised. There's concern in local government circles after the departure of 3 managers in 1 week from the Whangarei District Council. Independent councillors are alleging standover tactics by the Whangarei Mayor Stan Semenoff and some of his progress team. They say life has become intolerable for professional staff and they're calling for an audit inquiry. The president of the Society of Local Government Managers, Murray Douglas, says for 3 managers to leave at once is extraordinary.
There appears to be a major breakdown between senior staff and elected people. That's a matter of concern, obviously, to the professional side of the industry. And we're going to be following up to see if there's any way that we can assist in mediation or assisting putting back the public confidence in the whole process.
Murray Douglas says such incidents affect the public perception of management in local government. And that's the news.
whenua celebrates our country, Aotearoa New Zealand.
We keep in touch with Māori endeavours, the land, its peoples, music, the arts.
And each week we'll profile a Māori on the move.
What's happening on the marae of Māoridom? What are young people, the rangatahi, thinking about?
New books, new songs, and old ones too.
The cities, the country, all on whenua.
Join us on whenua twice weekly, 8 o'clock to 9 on Thursday nights
and 5 o'clock to 6 on Sunday afternoons on National Radio.
Forecast from Weather Workshop to midnight tomorrow, the north and west of the North Island from Northland to Waikato, including the Bay of Plenty, outbreaks of rain today, a few heavy falls in eastern areas from Northland to Bay of Plenty. Tomorrow rain with a few heavy falls at times. Waitomo, Tomaranui and the Central Plateau, mostly cloudy today, with one or two showers turning to patchy rain later today, tomorrow further rain at times. In the west, from Taranaki to Manawatu, fine apart from high cloud. Tomorrow, high cloud with some patchy rain spreading from the north late in the day. Kapiti Coast and Wellington, fine and sunny today, high cloud increasing tomorrow, late patchy rain possible. In the east, from Gisborne to Wairarapa, cloudy today, outbreaks of light rain or drizzle north of Hastings. Further rain tomorrow becoming heavy from Gisborne City northwards. The west coast fine today in most places, cloud increasing about the fjords. Tomorrow rain developing in Fiordland and spreading slowly northwards. Remainder of the South Island mostly fine weather. Some areas of cloud about the coast morning and night and some rain in Southland and Stewart Island from tomorrow afternoon. Chatham Islands fine today, cloudy periods tomorrow. That's the short forecast at 7 minutes past five. You're with National Radio.
Thank you, Chris. You're listening to Checkpoint with Mary Wilson. As you've heard, there's been a setback in efforts to settle Māori land claims with the collapse of the $40 million treaty settlement that had been reached between the Crown and the Eastern Bay of Plenty's Whakatohia people. The settlement was reached in October 1996 between the Crown and tribal negotiators. That settlement had to be ratified by tribal beneficiaries, but after 18 months, that still hasn't happened. The Treaty Negotiations Minister Doug Graham says it's clear there is insufficient Whakatohia support for the package, and he's terminated it. Doug Graham joins me now. Good evening.
Good evening, Mary.
When exactly did you terminate it?
Well, we had until the 31st of March as the deadline date, but I saw the negotiators yesterday or the day before, and it is clear that it's dead in the water.
So the Crown had issued a deadline?
Well, they had, under the deed, 6 months to get the ratification. We extended it, and they've now had really 18 months and haven't even got as far as having the referendum, so clearly they're not going to be able to do it.
What exactly has been the problem?
Well, unfortunately, there's been considerable dissent within the negotiating team, and they've been to the Māori Land Court to try to have some of those matters resolved on more than one occasion. And unfortunately, they don't seem to have quite sorted it all out. There's not much I can do about that.
Can you explain what the crux of the dissension is? Does it relate to money?
Oh, no, well, I wouldn't want to comment on that. You'd have to ask them. But there's really a group who want to do more research and renegotiate parts of it, and there's another group that doesn't. And in those circumstances, it's obviously not appropriate to try and hold the line, because it just wouldn't be durable. And my task is to try and reach final settlements.
So maybe you could criticise the Crown and tribal negotiators who got it wrong in the first place.
Well, I don't know that I'd say the Crown got it wrong. In good faith, negotiated. We put up an offer which was accepted at the time in good faith, and we've been waiting ever since to see whether it received the approval of the beneficiaries. And we're not involved in that process. So I can't do any more. And
did you have a feeling about this, though, when the treaty settlement was initiated?
I think it's developed more sense, although, I mean, obviously in these matters you're never going to get unanimity. But it's highly desirable, of course, that the negotiators themselves, I mean, there are 14 in this group, so it's not a matter of just two or three.
Why are there 14?
Because the Māori Land Court appointed 14 to represent Whakatohia.
Is it a particularly complex claim?
No, not
more
really.
So than others?
No.
So what happens now?
Well, now they will go away and do whatever research they think is necessary and want to do. And then when they're ready and perhaps a bit better united than they have been, they're free to come and approach the Crown again. But, of course, in the meantime, we've moved on. We've got other negotiations underway, others planned, and they'll have to take their turn a bit further down the track.
So they go to the bottom of the queue?
Well, not exactly, but it's not fair to the others who are in negotiation or poised to start to suddenly find that somebody who's already taken up a fair bit of time jumps the queue again. But, you know, who knows? There may be a bit of a gap and we may be able to make some progress. I sincerely hope so. It's certainly no question that there's a validity to this claim, and we would want to try and get it resolved.
Do you think that this development in any way questions the actual treaty negotiation process itself?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't think anybody's quibbling about that.
But these people clearly couldn't deal with the process.
Well, that's perhaps not surprising. These are big issues for tribal groups. Some are better organised than others, obviously. Some find their experience is not up to scratch and have to try and seek advice. Some have to try and find out where all their beneficiaries are because they've dispersed. So, you know, you just do the best you can. It's a setback, it's a disappointment, but it's not the end of the world, and we'll continue.
Thank you very much for your time. That's Treaty Negotiations Minister Doug Graham. Well, our Māori Issues correspondent Chris Wikaida joins me now. Chris, do you think this development is surprising?
No, it's not really. It had been on the cards for some time. The problems within the negotiating team and what the iwi overall were saying to them and their reaction to the deal that was put forward, this has sort of been bubbling away for quite some months.
The minister wasn't really prepared to comment on what the crux of the issue is. Can you?
A lot of it started with when the settlement that was signed back in if I stretch my memory back,
1996.
It was agreed to by Cabinet in September 1996, and it was signed on the 1st of October, I think. And what happened then was they took it back to the people for their ratification, and that's when a lot of the sort of, there was young people, particularly a movement of young people within Whakatau here saying, hang on, what's been going on here? We haven't really been consulted over this negotiation process.
What, they didn't like $40 million?
No, they didn't. No, not at all. And particularly because one of the parts of the settlement says that, okay, this will be a full and final settlement. And what a lot of people in Whakatau here were saying, well, no, we want this to be a settlement to do with the confiscation of the 170,000 acres that was seized in the late 1800s, not to do with other claims that the iwi had before the Waitangi Tribunal, and they wanted them to be kept distinctly separate. But the settlement said, no, this will be full and final. All issues will be dealt with by this $40 million. One of the key sticking points was that a lot of the land that was taken is now part of the conservation estate. And as try as they might during the negotiations, at that point the Crown said nothing in the conservation estate at all will become part of a treaty settlement. I think to rub salt into that wound is when the Ngāi Tahu settlement, which followed, there were elements of sort of dual management and areas where Ngāi Tahu have more say in what happens in areas of the conservation estate. And I think that sort of upset Whakatau here even more.
So that issue of land confiscation was considered to be the really crucial issue that the settlement didn't address?
Yeah, well, a lot of the land was either in the conservation estate or in private ownership now, so the law prevents that being returned. But they said, hey, what you're offering here is not enough to cover those losses.
Okay, but that was only one view.
That is only one view, and the other one is that differentiation between the confiscation for the supposed rebellion and that also centred around the killing of the missionary Volkner, the subsequent hanging of Kiriopa and Mokomoko because of that, although Mokomoko was pardoned in 1992. I mean, the validity of this claim does go back a long way. I mean,
there's some pretty intense feeling about it, obviously.
Oh, yes, back in the 1920s there was the Stout Ngata Commission, which said, yes, the penalty for what happened to Volkner and the Whakatau here rebellion to the Crown, the penalty was far too harsh. So they've been saying, hey, the government has acknowledged for a long time the grievance that we have, and Doug Graham has done that too. So the $40 million that is here to cover that, and supposedly our other treaty claims, that's not acceptable.
Right. Solvable, do you think?
It is solvable, but there's a lot of work to be done within the iwi itself. There are issues of mandate where there's a group of young people within the tribe particularly who are very vocal. They have some very well-educated people amongst them. They're saying, hey, the people who were part of the negotiating team, you didn't talk to us while you were going through this process. We want to have more input. So there is sort of a rebuilding and sort of refocusing that has to happen within Whakatau here before they all sort of start travelling on the same bus, so to speak, and start the process over again.
Thanks for that, Chris. That's our Māori Issues correspondent, Chris Wikaida. And we hope to be talking to the Māori MP for the area, Tuariki Delamere, later in the program. He was also involved in negotiating the original settlement. It's 16 minutes past five. You're listening to Checkpoint on National Radio. Coming up, Aucklanders march against Mercury Energy. But first, here's Rodney with the business news.
Thanks, Mary. Good afternoon. The top 40 index closed up 30 points at 2299. Air New Zealand B up 6 to 243. Fletcher Building up 10 to 394. Fletcher Energy down 5 to 605. Fletcher Forest up 3 to 130. Fletcher Paper up 2 to 248. INL down 10 to 820. Lion Nathan up 8 to 440. Telecom up 25 to 855. Telstra down up 10, sorry, to 442, and the warehouse up 4 to 440. The Australian All Ords 2729 up 10 points. Tokyo's Nikkei Index up 330 to 16905, and Hong Kong's Hang Seng up 106 to 11,009. The New Zealand dollar's buying 58.25 American cents, 86.56 Australian cents, 35.16 British pence, and 74.88 Japanese yen. 90-day bills 8.75%, 10-year government stock 6.86%. And one of Telecom's cornerstone American shareholders, Ameritech, is expected to start selling its quarter stake next week. The company's already been given the go-ahead to sell the stake in the same manner as Telstra has listed, through probably two instalments. The first instalment of around half the price payable immediately, and the second instalment in a year's time. An announcement may come in the US overnight tonight. A briefing is scheduled in New Zealand on Monday morning. One-off costs have put a demolition ball through the annual profit of Trans-Tasman Properties, slashing it from $22 million in 1996 to just an $892,000 profit last year. The 1997 operating surplus of $26 million was hammered, most notably by a $17 million bill for the listing of an Australian subsidiary, Australian Growth Properties, and the formation of the New Zealand Growth Property Trust. In other results reported today, property and hotel company Kingsgate enjoyed a 72% higher profit last year of $4.4 million. Fellow property investor CDL and suffered a 12% fall in profit to just under $8 million. New Zealand Experience made a whole $17,000, and in the red are Aquaria 21, a half-year loss of $1.2 million, and Seafresh, a first-quarter loss of $344,000. And that's business news.
Thank you, Rodney. Aucklanders, angry over the city's power crisis, have staged a protest march at the city centre, demanding the resignation of the chief executive of Mercury Energy, Wayne Gilbert. About 200 students, retailers, residents and workers marched up Queen Street in heavy rain, waving placards and black balloons. Our reporter Sharon Brett-Kelly was there. Wayne Gilbert and Mercury's board were the target of angry chants and placards as the protesters showed their anger over the power crisis and demanded accountability from the energy company. The turnout was well below the thousands expected by the organiser Empower Auckland, but the marchers and their noisy chants had the attention of Queen Street's lunch hour crowds. Among the protesters were teachers, retailers, students and people from outside the city centre who wanted to show their support and voice their frustration with Mercury Energy.
I'm very, very distressed at Mercury Energy's lack of responsibility to the consumers here in Auckland, and I think it's just the tip of the iceberg before we see the rest of our infrastructure eroded by the concept of privatisation.
I have a business that's going under, and I don't want compensation. I need compensation.
I think that there's a basic problem with the structure of Mercury Energy, and I think that that's a problem that's far-reaching throughout society, and it's getting worse all the time. The government wants to take it further.
I think Mercury is truly responsible for this calamity we have in the city at the moment, yeah? And I think they should bear the consequences and resign.
The march ended at Aotea Square. Empower Auckland's Nick Baines told marchers that Aucklanders are tired of excuses from politicians, lawyers and insurers.
And all of us know one thing. Mercury Energy has failed the city of Auckland and failed us monumentally.
Another speaker, Carol Beaumont from the National Distribution Union, said workers are suffering as well as retailers.
I'm appalled that this has happened at all and that I want workers to get compensated for the losses that they've experienced during the last few weeks.
A member of the Mercury Energy Consumer Trust, Victoria Carter, told the crowd she knows the pain retailers are going through.
The Trust has been pressuring the Mercury Board to provide the relief fund, suggested business solutions such as mediation, because we don't want to see lengthy litigation come out of the power crisis.
Meanwhile, a trust director and member of the Mercury board, John Collinge, walked out of the march early, upset at the tone of the protest. Mr. Collinge says he had planned to convey the protesters' message to the board, but left, upset at placards abusing Wayne Gilbert.
At this time, the whole priority must be getting Auckland back on to supply and security of supply, and supporting those who are working so hard to do that. And you know, that's where our effort has got to be.
John Collinge ending that report from Sharon Brick-Kelly. The insurance industry is also the target of mounting frustration over when businesses can expect to see some financial compensation. Last night on Checkpoint, Reg Newcomb, chairman of the retailer group Power for the People, had this to say.
They're refusing our claims, claims that have been legitimately okayed by the assessors and by solicitors. We have legitimate claims, and the insurance companies are backing off and saying, let's wait and see what the government inquiry produces.
Well, joining me now is Catherine Beard from the Insurance Council. Good evening.
Good evening.
Is that true that insurance companies are sitting on claims?
Absolutely not. The insurance industry is so concerned about this that they've actually launched their own investigation to find the cause of the problem and are not prepared to wait for a government investigation because they believe that consumers need to know where they stand.
Do you know if assessors have cleared claims which have not been processed?
No, assessors can't actually approve claims. The insurance company is underwriting the claim, so they actually have to, first of all, establish whether it is an insured, it's actually covered by the individual's insurance policy. Now, they can't do that until they establish the cause of the crisis.
And they don't know that yet, you're saying?
No. So we've actually launched an investigation. The insurance companies who are affected by this have got together and actually employed some independent expert engineers, and we're seeking access to the Mercury cables and are hoping to, once we get access, have some sort of result within 5 to 6 weeks.
Still a long time for people to wait, though. I mean, can you understand their frustration over this?
Oh, absolutely, which is why we've actually moved en masse before. We were very concerned and we didn't think that waiting for the result of a government inquiry was good enough. But at the end of the day, this is quite a complex matter and we need to determine the cause of the breakdown.
So the council itself is heading this inquiry?
The council's communicating on behalf of members. Not all of our members are affected by this. It's mainly insurance companies selling commercial policies.
And what about cooperation from Mercury? Are you going to get access to the cables?
Well, that's the question. And I understand that a letter went off yesterday to Mercury. And the next thing that the Insurance Council will be reporting on is whether we've actually had access or not. But we sincerely hope, for the sake of all insured policyholders out there, that we can get access as soon as possible.
Well, what if you don't?
Well, we have a problem on our hands, and then we'll be in a situation where we have to wait for the government inquiry, unless we can have public opinion somehow persuade Mercury that we need to get on with this as quickly as possible.
In essence, then, if your inquiry establishes that the power crisis was, if you like, an act of God, insurance companies pay out. If Mercury is to blame, Mercury pays.
That's about the I guess that's a fairly good summary. Insurance is about sudden and unexpected, and they've really got to find out whether this was due to, and we've heard in the media that El Nino was to blame and that the ground heated up, etc. So they've got to look into those sorts of things and see if that's the case or whether it was simply a case of gradual deterioration and wear and tear, in which case Mercury has a serious problem on its hands because wear and tear is not something that you can buy insurance for any sort of policy.
Would it have made any difference if Auckland, the central city, had been declared in a state of emergency?
It wouldn't have made any difference to individuals' insurance contracts, because they are contracts between individuals in a private setting. So, no. I mean, whether it would have made a difference in terms of what the government was prepared to do, I'm not sure, but certainly not for insurance.
Because one of the allegations has been that if the mayor had declared a state of emergency, insurance companies would have had to pay out immediately.
Well, that's totally bizarre. I've never heard of that before, and it's just not the way it works. I mean, insurance companies pay out where an event has occurred that is covered in the individual policy. If that is the case, and it might well be, then insurance companies will have no hesitation in paying out, but they first of all have to establish the cause.
So some people could have written in their contracts that, you know, there would be a payout under a state of emergency.
Oh, no, no. I mean, that's not a commercial approach. I don't think any insurance market in the world would operate like that. I mean, if the government wants to declare a state of emergency and funds are going to flow from that, it can only be out of government coffers. The government can't commit the private sector to paying out money where money's not due.
All right. And in the meantime, you're simply waiting to get this inquiry underway to get the information you need.
That's right. And we've already started that process.
How long, really, could it take a lot longer, in fact, than the 5 to 6 weeks that you're talking about?
Well, the engineers who have been employed by the industry, the brief that they've had is speed is essential. The industry is conscious that there are people out there who need a result, and in fact we're working with the broking industry who are part of this investigation as well, and they're obviously acting on behalf of their clients.
So you have highly specialised people, technical experts in this area, obviously.
Well, we've hired them, yes.
How much is that costing you, or indeed the entire investigation?
I understand it's probably somewhere over the $100,000 mark.
You think it's going to be worth it?
Well, it'll certainly be worth it, yes. I mean, we've got to get to the bottom of the cause.
Thank you very much for your time. That's Catherine Beard from the Insurance Council. Friday the 13th has lived up to its reputation for... No, we're leaving that story for a moment. We're going back to our earlier story regarding the Whakatauhia settlement, which, as we heard before, has been terminated. There was a $40 million treaty settlement signed between the Crown and tribal negotiators on October 1996. That settlement had to be ratified by tribal beneficiaries, but after 18 months, that still hasn't happened, as we heard before. Treaty Negotiations Minister Doug Graham has decided to terminate it. Joining me now is Māori MP for the Whakatauhia area, Tuariki Delamere, who was involved in negotiating the original settlement. Good evening.
Yes, good afternoon.
This must be very disappointing for you.
Well, it's not unexpected. What's disappointing is the fact, and first I should clarify that, you know, it was only ever an offer, so it was never an assigned agreement. It was an offer to the people of Whakatauhia, and the disappointing aspect for me is that the committee has never been able to put the offer to the people to consider, never had held the referendum. And
what committee?
I decided to terminate it.
What committee are we talking about?
The Whakatauhia Negotiating Committee, which was mandated by the Māori Land Court. Their job was to bring an offer and put it to the people of Whakatauhia for consideration.
Are you saying that the tribal beneficiaries never even really looked at this?
They have not had the opportunity to, you know, to consider the document in full. There's been a lot of, you know, meetings, tribal meetings on the marae, but, you know, there are about 8,000 beneficiaries all over New Zealand and some overseas. And, you know, for a number of issues, which are quite complicated, internal divisions within the committee and indeed the iwi, the settlement offer has not been sent to all the beneficiaries for them to consider. And as Doug
but
said,
there must
it's been
be
about
surely
18 months,
there must know. There must surely be a lot of people who could have been contacted.
Oh yeah, that's not a problem. I mean, we have a registered beneficiary list, I said, of 8,000. We have their addresses and everything, but I said there are a number of internal issues within the committee itself and other factions within Whakatauhia which were, you know, unable to resolve those differences. And what Doug has done is withdrawn the offer on this, and Whakatauhia will now go away and try and resolve those internal differences. And then when that is done, we will come back to the Crown to resume negotiations.
One of the criticisms that we've heard is that there wasn't enough negotiation with the beneficiaries.
Well, it's not a matter of negotiation. You can't go around and individually negotiate with all 8,000 beneficiaries.
No, I understand that, but the negotiators didn't communicate enough with the people.
When I dispute that, absolutely. What should have happened, we've had any number of meetings, but the agreement itself, I personally believe, should have been as soon as possible after it was the receipt of the offer was received from the Crown back in October 96. A copy of that should have gone to every registered beneficiary, and I believe those who opposed it, and there are those who opposed it, should have been able to put their viewpoints down and say, you know, 10 pages, 16 pages, that gone out as well, and those who support it put their reasons for supporting it, and then we should have had the referendum.
Well, why didn't that happen? Why not?
Well, as I said, there are a number of very complicated issues within the negotiating committee, and as Doug Graham says, I heard him in the car coming out the airport, the tribe has been back to the Murrayland Court a number of times, and it's been decided until we Whakatohe resolve our internal differences, it's better to withdraw that offer, and when that's done, the Crown will reconsider continuing with negotiations.
It is resolvable?
Oh, I believe it's resolvable, but you know, some hugely emotional issues, and a lot of the young people especially, and a lot of older ones, consider the offer was not fair. I've always believed in coming into Parliament, and probably upset some of my colleagues saying this, I believe none of the offers and settlements are fair in the context that, for example, just recently we settled with Equity Corp, $260-odd million, Drew Holdings, others, we settled at 100% compensation. And Māori feel somewhat aggrieved because their compensation tends to be about 4 or 5% of the loss.
All right, so if we do see some kind of movement on this, that the figure that we're talking about is going to be a lot more than $40 million.
Well, actually, you know, the differences within Whakatohe weren't actually that much to do with the money. There were other issues, but I don't want to air those as a private matters to Whakatohe. The $40 million was probably the least of the issues within Whakatohe. I'm just making a point that I don't believe, you know, in comparison to the way we settle a lot of non-Māori grievances, such as Equity Corp, we are quite happy to settle at 100% compensation, but it's a bit harder for Māori to get anywhere near that. You know, when you hear in the
that's
House
a, that's
last
a
week,
criticism, surely.
You were the ACT Party demanding full compensation for loss of private property. Yet I've never seen the ACT Party stand up and demand that when the people who have suffered the loss were Māori.
Maybe then that's an argument for getting rid of the treaty negotiations process and going straight to court.
Well, I think Māori would be very happy to go to court over it. Most cases, Māori have done quite well at the High Court level. But at the end of the day, you know, we need to work through the process. Whakatohe needs to sort out, you know, its issues privately and internally, and then we can get back to hopefully resolving the settlement. I mean, you know, resolving the grievance.
But do you think part of this is to do with the actual negotiating process itself, the treaty negotiation process?
Well, I'm not sure what other process you could use. I mean, at the end of the day, it has to be between, you know, the tribe and the Crown. There is no other one to negotiate with.
Well, you go to court, as we said before.
Well, you know, unless there's a change in law, that's not likely to happen anytime soon.
Okay. Look, thank you very much for your time. That's the Māori MP for the Whakatohe area, Tuariki Dalamia. With Checkpoint on National Radio, it's 25 minutes to 6.
Radio New Zealand News, I'm Chris Witter. The $40 million treaty settlement that had been reached between the Crown and the Opotiki-based tribe Whakatohe has collapsed. The Crown and tribal negotiators signed a deed of settlement in October 1996, but it hasn't been ratified by the beneficiaries. Treaty Negotiations Minister Doug Graham told Checkpoint there's been dissent within the negotiating team, and it became clear the settlement had to be terminated, but he says when the tribe is ready, it can make another approach to the Crown. Occupational safety and health officials are investigating today's accident in which a steel girder crashed through a roof in an inner city flat in Auckland. Three people escaped serious injury when the 12-metre beam weighing about 5 tonnes dropped from a crane working on extensions to a nearby hotel. A group of insurance companies has launched its own investigation into the Auckland power crisis so it can meet insurance policy claims. Catherine Baird from the Insurance Council says the companies weren't prepared to wait for the results of the government's inquiry. She says they've hired independent engineers and are seeking access to Mercury Energy's cables to find out the cause of the power failures. Labor's highlighting the future of rural roads as part of its Taranaki King Country by-election campaign. The leader, Helen Clark, met with the mayors of five rural Waikato councils in Te Awamutu today and called for the roading advisory report, which proposes commercialisation of roads, to be scrapped. She says if the government goes ahead with the proposals, the standard of roading for rural people will fall because less maintenance will be carried out. NASA now says an asteroid which is heading towards Earth won't hit. Yesterday, the International Astronomical Union said an asteroid will pass very close to Earth in the year 2028 and could possibly collide with it. But NASA says it's had a good look at the asteroid and believes it'll miss the planet by almost a million kilometres. And that's the news.
Thank you, Chris. You're listening to Checkpoint with Mary Wilson. Debate continues over the government's code of social and family responsibility. But if you are intending to respond, Checkpoint has discovered that the best way to get your views noticed is to classify yourself as a group. The Social Policy Agency says that's because there might be too many written answers from individuals. Melita Tull reports that concerns welfare and community groups.
Already, up to 38,000 questionnaires have been returned. The Social Policy Agency says all the yes and no answers will be analysed by computer. Written responses from groups will also be analysed, but individuals may not be so lucky. If too many write replies, only a sample may be read. The Social Policy Agency says it's working on how to take that sample. For Tina Reid from the Federation of Voluntary Welfare Organisations, it seems strange that more weight will be placed on group responses.
This seems a rather odd way of going about a consultation or a discussion about social policy. If the government was interested in group responses to these questions, there could have been another format, a way of engaging with groups. But in fact, this household's been sent to individuals, this questionnaire's been sent to all individual households to answer.
But the Social Policy Agency says the purpose of the survey is to generate discussion, and it's important to understand it's not a census, referendum, or scientific research of public opinion. That's left Bonnie Robinson, who's chief executive of the Council for Christian Social Services, wondering why the information's being collected and why it has to be back so quickly.
The concept of a code and a Social Responsibility Act has been knocked around for a number of years now. And all of a sudden, we have this consultation exercise, and it's got to happen very quickly. And I think there is a question about what is the agenda here, and why is it happening so quickly.
Meanwhile, there are plans for community and welfare organisations to rally in Wellington over the way the policy is being put together. Earlier this week, a meeting of 53 such organisations unanimously rejected the Code of Social and Family Responsibility, accusing the government of trying to shift the burden of welfare onto individuals.
That report from Melita Tull. And the issue does appear to have been reconsidered. A short time ago, John Angus from the Social Policy Agency told me that all responses to the code questionnaire would be read.
It was never correct to say that some individual and family responses would be totally ignored and thrown in the bin or whatever. We're always going to look at some of the information there. But we had to wait to see what the level of response would be, and we're now, on the basis of the information that we have, able to assure ministers and follow their direction that we will analyse all of the material and all of the response forms.
So the initial statement that not all the individual written responses will be read is wrong.
That's right. That was a contingency that we were looking at 3 or 4 weeks ago before we had an indication of the level of response and of the nature of the responses.
Okay, because I thought that you'd made that statement knowing already that because of the overwhelming number of responses that only a small sample could be taken and read.
No, I think that's incorrect. That was always a contingency that we were looking at, not a firm position. Ministers always wanted us to look at all of the responses, and that's our preference too.
Social Welfare Minister Roger Sowry has issued a statement this afternoon saying all responses which come in from the public on the proposed code will be analysed.
Yes.
Was that a direct response to your earlier comments?
No, I think ministers always wanted all of the responses analysed. The earlier comments that were made were considering what contingency we would use if we were absolutely flooded with responses.
But now you're being told that it doesn't really matter how many responses you get, it will all be analysed.
Well, I think we've got some indication about the level of response and the nature of the response. We're 3 weeks into the process now.
Is it more than 10%? Because that's what it has been budgeted for.
We've had 40,000 responses, approximately 39,377 as of lunchtime today. It's common to get a peak of responses early in the process, so we are confident that we will be able to handle all of the responses that come in and analyse all of them.
That's John Angus of the Social Policy Agency. In Indonesia, pressure is increasing on newly reappointed President Suharto to reform the political system and the economy. Student-led protests calling for greater democracy are intensifying, the rupiah is still falling, and the International Monetary Fund continues to demand radical reforms. Jonathan Swass asks what lies ahead.
Quoted in a recent issue of the London Observer, an Indonesian political analyst, Dr. Hermawan Sulustio, said about his country, "If you are patient and wait until April, you will see the last revolution of the 20th century." Another observer, a lawyer, who will leave unnamed for one of Indonesia's leading human rights organisations, says while he thinks reform rather than revolution is the goal of most activists, unrest and violence are growing in parallel with the decline of the economy.
But the riots will erupt at any time in cities in Indonesia. So we expect that it will be arrests or probably even killings among the people.
Not everyone is pessimistic. Jerry Van Klinken, the editor of the Australian-based magazine Inside Indonesia, says it's quite possible there'll be a transition to a more democratic state within the next few years through a Philippine-style people power movement.
That, of course, was a completely peaceful overturn in the elite in the Philippines, and some democracy activists in Indonesia, are envisaging this kind of protest in the absence of more constitutional or regular kind of elite turnovers.
Jerry Van Klinken agrees, though, there is potential for large-scale violence if any people power uprising finds itself pitted against Indonesia's powerful and politically active military.
I'm still hopeful that it could be non-violent and peaceful, and there are precedents for doing that, but certainly democracy activists will have to be very careful in the next few months.
Jerry Van Klinken concedes that as yet there's no people power movement in existence or even in sight. The autocratic Suharto is newly reappointed to power, and he has always shown himself ruthless in suppressing dissent. As yet, the president shows no signs of bowing to the IMF demands for structural economic reform, which all raises the spectre of continuing economic and political tension. Nevertheless, the chairman of the New Zealand-Indonesia Business Council, Sir Ron Carter of Becker, Carter, Hollings and Ferner, remains relatively upbeat about Indonesia's longer-term prospects. He says the current economic crisis means that returns on his business, designing and managing construction projects, are down perhaps a half on what they were a year ago, but he won't be pulling out.
We have 20 people, 8 of whom have families there, and they're all living and working and continuing on in the area. We may have to reduce the amount of staff we have over the next few months, but we will stay there with confidence that the Indonesian business will still be worthwhile for us, and I think for all companies. It's a big country with a lot of human and physical resources, material resources, which will get back into the world marketplace at some point.
Sir Ron Carter points out that he's been working in Indonesia for 25 years and that, despite frequent predictions of imminent social crisis, the political situation has always stayed under control. He's confident that revolution or other serious unrest can be avoided and that Indonesia will return to being a good place in which to do business. For many Indonesians, though, the central question is whether Indonesia will be a good place in which to live. It's that issue, as much as anything, which will determine the country's stability in the months ahead.
Jonathan Swoss with that report. It's 5:45. You're listening to Checkpoint on National Radio. And here is Richard Crowley with the latest sports.
Good evening. Don't count on Japan releasing Graham Bashup for the Super 12. The former All Black halfback wants to come home to replace the injured Justin Marshall at the Crusaders. But Japanese Union Secretary Koji Tokumatsu says a release is unlikely because Bashup can't be allowed to break IRB rules and be a professional player in two different countries. However, he says they're anxious to help if they can and not to cause offence where it's not meant.
We don't want to give a bad impression or wrong impression to the people of New Zealand. I'm just telling my opinion to the chairman that nowadays we have to follow the international standards.
Koji Tokumatsu. Meanwhile, a capacity crowd of 22,000 is expected in Hamilton for the Chiefs Hurricanes Super 12 clash tonight. That match is due to start at 7:30. There'll be no love loss when Manly takes on the Broncos in the opening round of the new NRL league competition in Brisbane tonight. Former Manly centre Craig Innes is picking the fur to fly between the bitter rivals.
I think in this round, especially this first round, I think the games between the Super League teams and ARL teams, there's going to be plenty of heat, especially up there. I think Brisbane have been looking forward to having Manly visit for quite a while, so you know, I think it's going to be all on.
Craig Innes. Meanwhile, the Warriors play Souths in Auckland tonight, where it's been raining most of the day. At wins for Canterbury and Wellington in Shell Trophy cricket action today. Canterbury beat Northern by an innings and two runs to join Otago at the top of the points table, while Wellington down central by 7 wickets at the Basin Reserve. That's the latest in sport.
Thank you, Richard. Friday the 13th has lived up to its reputation for Aucklander Grant Triplow, who was in bed this morning when a huge girder crashed through the roof of his inner-city apartment, crushing the wall between two bedrooms. The 5-ton piece of steel fell from a construction site on top of a 7-storey building. Grant Triplow and two of his flatmates were inside their neighbouring 3-storey apartment at the time.
I thought the crane outside, which is kind of stuck onto the side of the building, had fallen down, and it hadn't. And so the next thing, the only other thing was something's fallen through our roof, which that's what it sounded like. And well, obviously, yeah, and so we went out. We heard a few bit of groaning. Matt, my flatmate, heard some groaning, went into the room and saw one of the girls pinned down in some state of shock looking upwards. He was thinking she was dead. Then she moved and he helped her out. And another flatmate of mine was just completely white with plaster and debris and stuff. And then she was fine. She came out. Yeah, and then we rang the ambulance, and after a while we had construction guys coming down, and yeah.
What does the flat look like at the moment?
We can't go in there. Two of us have had access because our rooms are quite far away from, well, not far away, on the other side of the building. But the rest of them can't get in there, and there's just, their positions are just completely ruined because of the rain and the girder actually falling, crushing bits to smithereens. The one girl's computer is just completely underneath it, and fortunately she was going to shift her bed there, and another flatmate was going to have a shower, and had they done that, they wouldn't be in this taxi right now with me. Yeah.
Incredible, isn't it?
It's bizarre. And it's the craziest of luck, because we're just getting comfortable in the flat. Everyone was happy, we get on really well. Really nice bunch of people. And all of a sudden this happens, and we don't know where we're going to go now. I think we're going to head to Centro Hotel for a few days. They're going to put us up.
Never a dull moment in Auckland. That's a most fortunate Grant Triplow. It's almost 6:10. Time for Mana News. Kia ora to Nivak Ilulahia.
I'm Navaki Lolahia and welcome to Mana News. The $40 million Whakatohe settlement is off. Yesterday, Whakatohe claim negotiators asked the Minister for Treaty Negotiations, Doug Graham, to treat the deal as a raupatu settlement only. The deed was a comprehensive settlement of all Whakatohe's historical claims, but this was not acceptable to a majority of the iwi. However, renegotiation was clearly unacceptable to the minister, and he announced this afternoon that the deed will be terminated at the end of the month, and the two parties, the Crown and Whakatohia, are back to square one. Doug Graham says the negotiators should contact him when they are a united group and have completed further research they wish to undertake. He says he's not prepared to give Whakatohia any precedence over negotiations with other iwi which are already in the pipeline. Te Tawharau o Whakatohia, the group of Whakatohia people who strongly oppose the settlement, have always said they would prefer to see the whole deal called off if it cannot be substantially changed to protect the iwi's treaty rights. ACT spokesperson on education, Donna Awatere Huata, will present a new election policy to her party this weekend. ACT is holding a conference to prepare the party for the 1999 election. Donna says a number of new ideas will be discussed, including her zero tolerance policy.
Well, my aim at this conference is to raise with ACT membership the notion that we should be setting a zero tolerance for failure in schools. And I've developed a program of action for that, setting a number of goals and strategies. For instance, in reading, I believe that we ought to have 95% of our children reading at their level by the age of seven, and that every child should leave school able to read and write properly. Leave primary school, I don't think that's an unrealistic goal. I think that we have to lift our game in terms of math, and I see no reason why we can't aim to be in the top five countries in the world within 5 years.
Donna will also call for more Māori to join the party.
I would like to see a lot more Māori join ACT and work towards lifting the education achievement of our people. I believe that there are two ways that ACT is quite unique. The first is in that it is demanding much higher standards and far greater choice for parents, and that has to benefit Māori children. And secondly, in its no-nonsense attitude towards welfare. And my own concern for our people is that if you've got more than half of us dependent on a benefit, then that is no model for the next generation to follow. And we have to somehow break that cycle. It is going to be difficult, and I believe that ACT is committed to that. And I guess if we had more Māori in ACT, that would certainly help.
Donna Awatere Huata. Te Runanga o Ngāti Porou will tomorrow begin a round of 25 consultation hui to seek the iwi's views on their future direction. A panel including Hekia Parata, Gina Rudland, John Tamihere, James Johnston, Nohoro Hapu and Awarangi Jury reviewed the Runanga last year. Hekia Parata says their findings are included in a discussion document called Mana Motuhake, Ngāti Porou Future Directions.
It focuses on issues like what kinds of priorities should there be in the economic development area, what kind of role and function should the Runanga perform in terms of the delivery of social services, should it be positioning to be a purchaser instead of a provider, thus creating opportunities for Ngāti Porou people to be providers themselves. What kind of education system and practice do we want to have in Ngāti Porou? What kind of health provision do we want to have?
Hekia says as well as seeking priorities from Ngāti Porou people, the Runanga is looking at other developments.
In the forestry area, and regrettably the Asian financial crisis is having an impact on us at the moment, but forestry will always be a big part for Ngāti Porou. Fishing, because of our long coastline, potential for ecotourism, the potential for energy resource type development, and I think probably the potential for capitalising on information and intellectual type resource development and using information technology.
Hekia Parata. That's the sound of Tip Arnell singing the blues with the Ian Logan Jazz Ensemble. They're part of the Fringe Festival in Wellington tonight. Tip, who's Te Opori and Te Rarawa, believes her singing talent comes from being Māori.
I've actually been blessed, I think, because I found out my father died when I was 16, but I found out since that he used to sing in a band and he apparently sounded like Nat King Cole. So I think, I've been gifted with some of his special talent, as well as perhaps talent from my mother's side, a very musical side too.
Tip was a Henry Rudolph singer in the 70s, took a break to have children and began singing again by chance.
Well, I've been very fortunate to meet Ian Logan, mainly through him having an art gallery, and I'm a part-time picture framer, so that's actually how we met. And then I said, I can sing, and we got chatting, and of course Ian plays piano. At that time, Ian had an American gentleman who really ended up becoming my mentor, and he said, you should be singing the blues. So hence, yeah, I've decided to try that style of singing, which I'm really enjoying.
The 45-year-old says her long time in the business should be an example for other Māori who want to sing.
You cannot tell me a Māori can't sing. They're only very shy and inhibited. That's been a bit of a fault on my part too, as a younger person. But, you know, slowly I've learnt to blossom.
And that's Mana News. I'm Nivaki Lolahia. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Nivak. An endangered North Island species is about to vanish altogether. Glass milk bottles will disappear from their last stronghold following the decision to stop making them. The last major North Island milk bottle plant closes next month. Caitlin Cherry takes a look at the bottle's demise.
Hang on, what's this? There's someone on the pitch. It's McKinnon's mum. Yes, it's Mrs. McKinnon, and she's carrying milk.
Most of us probably remember putting the milk bottles out after school and lugging the full crate back up the path. Now only South Islanders will get to hear the sounds of the clinking milk bottles. The last major North Island bottling plant is run by Mainland in Masterton. It will close its doors at the end of April. Mainland's category manager, Jeff Norgate, says with less than 5% of its North Island milk sales now in glass bottles, the company had no choice.
It's all about societal changes, really. 7-day trading and extended supermarket hours and increased available alternative options, really, where you can purchase milk. People are working longer, the two-income families means no one at home anymore to put the milk bottles out or collect them when they're delivered.
Jeff Norgate says Mainland hasn't taken the decision lightly, and it had even tried to convince more people to buy bottled milk, but he says the consumers have voted with their wallets. The first milk bottles were introduced in 1946. Back then they came in quarts. Many New Zealanders have fond memories of those times, like poet Sam Hunt.
I remember as a child when milk bottles came in. And in Milford, on Milford Beach in Auckland, pre-Harbour Bridge, we used to have a man called Mr. Anderson who came round with I think I can still remember the horse and cart with the milk pails on the back, and they would put your milk, you'd put your billy out, and that would be filled overnight.
Sam Hunt says the loss of milk bottles is yet another example of New Zealand society becoming less and less community-based.
But certainly that feeling of people in the community who were sort of, were responsible for what they dealt. The butcher, you know, the baker, the milkman, and all those and all those people. Yeah, I mean, there's you know, we all have our, but it's just made fairly anonymous now, and that bothers me. Faceless sort of society that we can end up living in. And we've got to battle, that's the one we've got to battle against.
And people I spoke to in downtown Wellington agreed that waving goodbye is a sad loss.
You do get used to not having the bottles, but I've still got them in my bottle crate in the bottom of the pantry.
Milk just looked more like milk in a bottle than it does in a cardboard carton.
I used to be a milk person. I used to deliver milk, and there was something about it. You can't get your fingers around a carton.
It was my job, yeah, collecting the milk. Yep. Used to be safe to leave the money in the bottles too.
I've always used them all my life. Even when I was a child, we had bottles.
I think it's terribly and horribly sad. I've just gotten back to New Zealand and I was out in Karori the other day. I saw a lovely Anglican minister with knee-high socks and a paper under his arm and his little milk bottle and his little wire trolley crossing the road. It touched my heart. It felt like a New Zealand event that's going to be gone forever now, I think.
Ernie was only 52. He didn't want to die. But now he's gone to make deliveries in that milk round in the sky, where the customers are angels and ferocious dogs are banned, and a milkman's life is full of fun in that fairy dairy land.
That report from Caitlin Cherry. That's our programme for the evening and for the week. Highlights can be heard in late edition at 10:15. From me, Mary Wilson, and the Checkpoint production team, I hope you have a fabulous weekend.